for the benefit of those that are maybe in the future listening to us on tape and all, this is the second discussion of the chapter about the body and the earth in The Unsettling of America by Wendell Berry. And we're going to be discussing, hopefully this will be we'll be able to have a lot of good dialogue tonight about marriage. Okay. Wendell Berry has a lot to say about marriage, about sexuality, about fidelity, and about wildness. And I know for myself, in the last, 6 or 7 years since college, or during college, even during high school, I've been thinking a lot about these questions, especially about marriage. You know, is marriage what I want to do? Do I want to be married and fall into the same patterns as my parents, you know, and all that? Let's see, where do we go from here? So for me, it's been a real relevant chapter, this whole chapter has. Can we just open it up for discussion, or should we do a brief sort of overview of this part of the chapter that we're talking about?
Would that be good? I would like that, because I haven't read it. Is anybody else in the same boat? I can just...
Okay, I'll try to do it fairly quickly. There's just a lot in here, and it's hard to pick things out. But I think last time we briefly touched over the division of male and female, competition between body and soul and male and female and all that stuff. Then he talks about the dismemberment of the household. If you can imagine a cathedral that's taken apart, all the parts are taken apart, and they're thrown out on a field or something. He says that the household can also be seen like this, that today we see the household as something that's just taken apart, and each of these parts has no relevance to the other. I mean, the unity of the household is lost. And the household used to be the physical bond between the man and the woman, the husband and wife. It was something that brought them together out of necessity. They worked together, and so they also loved together. They loved because they were working together. They were working towards the same goals and stuff like that. And Wendell Berry seems to say that today, when we're working away from home, and things are always better away from home, we go outside of the home for entertainment, even if we have TV, our minds are leaving home and going somewhere else, that now all there is to a marriage often is just the sexual act bringing a marriage together. I think that's a real general statement, but that's what we're talking about here in the dismemberment of the household. So that the, getting back to this cathedral image where everything's all spread apart, the work is spread over there, the sex is here at home, and maybe somewhere else. You know, he didn't go into that, but you go to the grocery store to buy your food instead of doing all these, the household pulling everything together. So that's sort of what the chapter, the part on dismemberment of the household was about. He also talked about the isolation of sexuality. He says, makes it subject to two influences that dangerously oversimplify it: the lore of sexual romance and capitalist economics. By sexual romance, I mean the sentimentalization of sexual love that for generations has been the work of popular songs and stories. By means of them, young people have been taught a series of extremely dangerous falsehoods, and he lists 8 of them. Things like, that people in love ought to conform to the fashionable models of physical beauty, and that to be unbeautiful by these standards is to be unlovable. That people in love are or ought to be young, even though love is said to last forever. Love alone, regardless of circumstances, can make harmony and resolve serious differences. That love will find a way. That the right partners are made for each other in heaven. That lovers are each other's all, or all the world to each other. And the last one, that monogamous marriage is therefore logical and natural, and, quote, forsaking all others involves no difficulty. And then he goes on to say how these poor people, once they're married, they find out that it's not all a bed of roses and there's a lot of work to do to make the marriage work. These things aren't just ready-made in heaven, that you gotta work at them and stuff. And he's saying that our culture tends to encapsulate marriage, that because these two people are supposed to be each other's all, you know, they're just grouped together so that other men or other women aren't a threat to this unit. They kind of build walls around themselves. And I know each family is different, but my family, we didn't have very many people over all the time, and my mom and dad seemed to be each other's only friends, and it was really an encapsulation, protection sort of thing. And he says that this encapsulation is just another, it's analogous to what we do with our agriculture, where we take a field and we separate that field from everything around it, from the wilderness, from other plants and stuff like that. And we try to solve one problem, but in doing that, we come up with a lot of other problems. So we solve one problem, but a lot of problems develop around that. The same with marriage, he's saying. Marriage that our culture now is dominant in our culture today. Let's see, where are we here? So the protective capsule becomes a prison. The marriage shrinks to a dull vigil of duty and legality. Husband and wife become competitors necessarily, for their only freedom is to exploit each other or to escape. Now, I don't know how much this relates to your families, but I know in my family, I mean, I know my mother went into a deep depression when the kids left home. It was a serious thing. And during that time, I found out that many of my own friends' mothers were going through the same thing. And the fathers are kind of going through similar things in a different way. They're distant. They're far from home. You know, there's something troubling about many marriages of our parents' generation, I find. I hope that, you know, your families are all nice and all, but Wendell Berry sees a problem. Then he goes on to talk about fidelity. How to start this? Fidelity as being an idea of being responsible to something, to your husband or wife, to you, to a piece of land. See, he's still making these connections between marriage and the land. Being, faithful? Being faithful to your field means taking care of it properly so that it can grow and prosper and be fully productive. The same with being faithful to your husband or wife, or I guess we're talking about husbands and wives, or your friends even, I would say. Being faithful to them means taking care of them, respecting them, letting them live their fullest. So he says, the idea of fidelity today is perverted beyond redemption by our understanding it as a grim, literal duty enforced only by our willpower. I think that's pretty fair. Anyone cannot be good anyhow by just being bad is, I guess I'm taking that out of context a little. To be faithful merely out of duty is to be blinded to the possibility of a better faithfulness for better reasons. And then he goes on to say how we've lost the reason for being vital. Is that a word, vital?
Faithful.
Okay. Faithfulness or being faithful. Let me find the sentence and read it. He says it better than I do. Okay. If a virtue, he's talking about fidelity as being a virtue. If a virtue has been thought a virtue long enough, it must be assumed to have practical justification, though the very longevity that proves its practicality may obscure it. That seems to be what's happened with the idea of fidelity. We hear the words, forsaking all others, repeated over and over again for so long that we lost the sense of their practical justification. They assume the force of superstition. People came to be faithful in marriage not out of any understanding of the meaning of faith or marriage, but out of the same fear that, or of obscure retribution that made one careful not to break a mirror or spill salt. And he goes on about it being a superstition. Does anyone who hasn't read the book, I mean, can you think of any reasons for, well, maybe we should, I'll ask that question later when we get into discussion. It says, our age could be characterized as a manifold experiment in faithlessness. So then he talks about, there must be a purpose for fidelity. Otherwise, why would we be carrying it on for all these years and years and years? There must have been a reason. And he comes up with at least two things here. The marriage vow unites not just a woman and a man with each other. It unites each of them with the community in a vow of sexual responsibility towards all others. That's one, sexual responsibility. The second one, another use of fidelity, is to preserve the possibility of devotion against the distractions of novelty. Get that? What marriage offers and what fidelity is meant to protect is the possibility of moments when what we have chosen and what we desire are the same. Such a convergence obviously cannot be continuous. No relationship can continue very long at its highest emotional pitch, but fidelity prepares us for the return of these moments, which gives us the highest joy we can know, that of union, communion, and atonement in the root sense of at-one-ment. The principle is, well, then he goes on with a poem here. To forsake all others does not mean, because it cannot mean, to ignore or neglect others, to hide or be hidden from all others, or to desire or love no others. To live in marriage is a responsible way to live in sexuality, as to live in a household is a responsible way to live in the world. One cannot, well, let's see, he goes on about that. So, did you get those two reasons? To prevent irresponsible sex, I have written down, and to protect from distraction of novelty is what he was saying the uses of fidelity are. You get
what does that?
That
mean?
Well, it's like saying, okay, so you're married, for instance, or you have a commitment to someone, and someone else attracts you. And you have an attraction for this person and you pursue it and maybe become physical with that person. Well, that love dies down real quickly. It's just infatuation. say. And you try to come back to your original relationship, and that's kind of messed up because of this whole thing. It's avoiding distractions of things that aren't as meaningful and long-lasting and as relevant. Yeah.
Marvelous words.
Yeah. Let's see, what else? There's just a lot in here, and we can maybe focus on fidelity, and then I'd like to skip over a couple things here.
There's one part on right past where you ended up there that I like. Middle of the paragraph, top of page 123. There can be no such thing as a global village. No matter how much one may love the world as a whole, one can live fully in it only by living responsibly in some small part of it. Mm-hmm. A little bit later on, one can become whole only by the responsible acceptance of one's partiality.
Yeah. That's a, I really enjoyed that. Meaning that in relation to marriage and sexuality and all, you'll feel attracted, like there's an instinct, a sexual instinct where you could probably fall in love with anybody, you know. Sometimes you feel like that, you're just attracted to all these people. But your energies go into one relationship, a particular relationship. And through that particular relationship, you're also living in the world, in the general. You can also, there's also room to recognize your attraction to other people. The same as you can only love the world by living in your one place first. And after you love your one place, then you can automatically, you won't, hopefully you wouldn't want to destroy another place. You would recognize the value. But he also talks about wildness, in this necessity of wildness, and this is skipping over to page 130. And I think this is a good contrast. Again, the analogy of a field, if you have one field and it's separated, say, with a dome, it's totally isolated and encapsulated. It's away from the weather. It's away from other wild seeds that might blow in. In another place, he talks about Peruvian agriculture. And instead of large fields that are separated from everything else, they have very small fields. And in between these small fields, there's wilderness. I mean, there's weeds. And the seed, the weeds cross-pollinate with the potato plants there. They have weed potatoes and regular potatoes. And these, the joining of these two produce high-quality resistant strains and lots of different varieties, so that, like in our fields here, the monocultures can be wiped out by one disease, because they're all the same, and if they have, you know, a weakness, then they're all gone. Whereas if you have lots of different things, it's stronger, it's more resilient. And using that analogy to marriage, well, I didn't think that he came across, well, I guess it would be hard for me to put into words the analogy, but can you kind of make the jump from fidelity to seeing the usefulness of maybe your attractions to other people in keeping your own marriage fresh? And he says at the end of it that he doesn't have any answers to this. He sees a need for this wildness, but he doesn't. And he says even somewhere in here that there should be a ceremonially accepted, so you do a ceremony to accept that you do have attractions to others and that you do need a little bit of wildness, but he doesn't have any solutions. He says, what forms or revisions of forms may be adequate to this double faith, that faith of being faithful and the faith of being faithful to your instincts. I do not know. Cultural solutions are organisms, not machines, and they cannot be invented deliberately or imposed by prescription. Perhaps all that one can do is clarify as well as possible the needs and pressures that bear upon the process of cultural evolution. Then, let's see. I am certain that, what am I trying to find here? Okay. I am certain that neither can be changed for the better in experimental prescriptive ways we have been using. Ways of life change only in living. To live by expert advice is to abandon one's own life. So he's saying, go for it. You know, I don't know the answers, but there's a problem, and you got to go for the answer just by living and experimenting. Does that promote any conversation?
When I read the wildness section, I didn't really understand it very well.
Mm-hmm. Can you, like, be specific about something you don't understand?
No, I can't. It might be possibly because wherever he's mentioning Paris and Calypso, and I don't really know who those folks are.
Paris and Calypso, I don't know either, except that I read the previous part of the chapter. Oh, Eric, why don't you tell us who Paris and Calypso are? Do you know?
Yeah, well, they're both people from the Odyssey who were responsible for infidelities or hiatuses in marriage. Menelaus was married to Helen, and Paris lured her off through the connivance of Aphrodite. And that started the Trojan War. Helen was a married woman who ran off with another man. And the Greeks didn't like that. That was the king's personal property, and you don't run off with the king's personal property. So they started a war over it. And the Trojans, and then Calypso was a lovely woman, actually a goddess, who befriended Odysseus on his travels back and offered him paradise, really, and could have given him immortality. It's kind of the ultimate mistress. But he yearned for his wedded wife, Penelope, and left Calypso. So they represent kind of the ultimate lovers outside of marriage, the threats, the sexual threats to marriage.
Thank you, Peter.
And I think he is vague in wildness, but I think he was saying there, it was interesting, after making all these very powerful claims for fidelity, saying that if you're really rigid in your, you know, say, boom, no sex of any kind outside of marriage, you know, just close down the doors, you're going to have problems in marriage. Mm-hmm. You can't close off instinct. You can't manage instinct that vigorously, no matter how, idealistic your reasons are.
So you have to find a way to cope with it, and that's, I think, what his task for us is, whether that means you have physical sex with other people or whether you can change your attitude towards your attractions and enjoy them for what they are. Or I'm sure there's lots of other solutions and possibilities. I was really surprised when I was talking with a couple friends of mine, a couple really good friends of mine, about attractions to other people, and a lot of people think that you don't have any attractions to anybody else once you're married. And I'll just let you know, whoever doesn't know that, that that's not true, and it's something you have to deal with your whole life. And if you can use it positively, it can be, I think, a wonderful thing.
Though I think he'd say by definition you ought not, he would not like that attitude, using that.
Or incorporating it into your life, maybe.
Yeah, this is the idea of wildness is the absence of control.
Yeah. One thing that might be interesting to talk about, he gets it there, and in embodiment, James Nelson gets at, the notion of the fidelities involved in marriage. And at a time when marriage involved living together in many ways, your connectedness was multifold, then sexual infidelity needn't be that big a breach or a threat, however one may view it. But in the modern family, when sex is the only connection between man and wife, then sexual fidelity raises real problems. What do you have without, if you don't have sexual fidelity, what kind of fidelity do you have? And it's part of the the very tenuous, sick, narrow bondage of modern families that puts an enormous burden on sex, both within the home, quite apart from what's going on outside, and then makes then any sexual infidelity highly threatening to one or both of the partners, because that's all they've got. That's what they do together, and they don't have it without that. What have we got going?
Another thing, this is changing the subject a little maybe, but another thing he talks about, he does talk about the Odyssey, and I don't know how many of you have read either the whole chapter or had know about the Odyssey, but in it, this guy goes off to the wars and is fighting wars and everything, and then he has this affair with this goddess and all, Calypso, and he chooses to go home to his farm, to his wife, to this peaceful place. That's also a thing that he mentioned was choice. That it's important to either have had wildness or, like your college days, you try everything, or you go through an experimenting time, getting to know lots of different people, and then maybe you're ready. Well, maybe I'm putting too much of my own thoughts into marriage, but going from a wild thing into choosing a more settled relationship. And there's a part in here, I don't know what page it is, or I'd look it up, but something about every once in a while you might need to go away so that you can choose to come back, so that you're not in a prison. You don't have to be there. You're there by choice. I think that might open it up to those who aren't married yet and who aren't actually contemplating marriage and stuff.
Christy?
Yeah?
One other thing I think about this fidelity is I wonder how disconnected our sex is from having children, from the whole concept
that too.
Of children. And it seems that fidelity would include then some sort of understanding of sexuality in terms of the future, in terms of children, and to be connected in a... It seems like, as far as myself, and I think I'm just totally lost in that. I don't think I ever grew up... My growing up didn't include my consciousness specifically of children,
Or sex as being related to children.
Yeah, right, sexuality. And so that's just one thing that's been sort of coming up.
Do other people feel that way?
I think I had the opposite experience.
Really?
I remember in sixth grade when the Pope was Vatican II time, the Pope was again speaking largely against any kind of birth control.
Uh-huh.
My mother had given me her anatomy physiology lecture before and left me quite disgusted of you do that. And I remember saying to my sister, what's this hassle about birth control? Either you do it or you don't. And my mom had forgotten to emphasize that it is an act of love. Sexual expressions not only mean babies, and my college age sister had to kind of sit me down. So I really divorced it.
But I hope I don't offend anybody, but Catholics don't think that way, do they? Don't they think that, sex is just for procreation? But then when you look, when you see Playboys or Penthouse or something, that the grocery store, you don't think, well, I'd certainly like to propagate.
Yeah.
I mean,
right.
It seems like a propagation and sexuality are almost two.
Yeah.
At least in our society.
Wendell Berry talks a lot about that in here. He says that that's another one of these blocks that have been taken in the dismemberment of the household, you know, all these blocks strewn all around, and that, this is mixing metaphors, but he does also say that taking this, sectioning off sexuality has created a big rift. There's sexual experts, that means people who make birth control and sell it and stuff, and then there's always those people who mine that rift for gold. He also mentions birth control and that, and pornography and stuff like that. That's pretty interesting.
How does he put birth control and pornography together?
Okay, maybe I should find it so I'm not misquoting.
But just as two examples of separating our sexuality from the procreation.
Yeah, okay. It's like separating the fact that we eat from agriculture.
Yeah, but one could push that in too Puritan a way, and he's a bit funny. He becomes very Puritan about birth control here. In a way that's
is it
kind of strange.
Or,
oh, well,
that's,
you
what
just positively fierce.
I
mean, in forms of birth control. Well, that we're a little too glib with that, and I can see that. But he, you know, in his argument, I think he comes down very, I thought, in a kind of puritanical way about it. But in another sense, he does acknowledge that sex is playful. I mean, it's not like, you know, when you go to bed, you've got to be thinking, I'm creating a child
now. Right.
And if you're not thinking that, and that's not your intention, you are sinning by going to bed, which is simply isn't true. So that sex has multiple purposes. One very important one being procreation. One thing that's interesting, it's related to marriage. With the Ascent of Man, Bronowski was talking about genes and genetic replication. And I'm maybe misrepresenting, kind of vulgarizing what he was saying, but there is an interesting, actual sexual desire is very diffuse. You can be drawn to people, as a man, to women by whom you would not particularly want to have children. Mm-hmm. You just want to make love. But marriage is very selective, and there is something genetic going on there. You marry a woman by whom you would want to have children. I mean, you're not calculating genetic mix and anything, but he says, you know, maybe he dealt with romance, in terms of the evolution of the species and creating things, that sense of children, producing children, makes marriage choice very serious. And, you know, that is a real commitment, even though you don't think, oh, what kind of kids are we going to have? But sex, interestingly, sexual attraction before and after marriage, is more... flighty, tenure. I mean,
yeah. Well, a kid is a real thing.
Yeah.
Sex passes with time. John?
I'd say that in the past, marriage generally was. Having children was one of the things that was just sort of expected. You get married and you're going to have children.
Mm-hmm.
That is no longer the case. Or at least it can't be assumed to be the case. You know, and I think that may be one of the reasons why some of the standards or whatever you want to call them have been breaking down, is that it has become just a sex for pleasure thing for some people. And they have no intention of having children, and then it becomes just a sexual attraction thing.
Yeah, except I think it's deeper than that. I mean, like, some people can't have children. I wouldn't put those into the category that...
I'm not going to say that those who can't have children or don't want to have children are not committed to each other. But I think it makes it easier for people to
take sex lightly.
Take it lightly, and just and go into marriage without a really deep commitment.
But then, aren't you assuming that, again, sex is the main connection in marriage? What if people committed themselves to each other, not because they wanted to have children, not because they thought they'd have terrific sex together, but because they wanted to live together in a mutually affirming way?
I don't think I was excluding that.
Well, you were saying without children, marriage becomes...
It's taking one more factor out of the equation, but I wasn't saying that that was not...
Melinda, did you have something?
Well, I don't know. It's interesting listening to what people respond, I think, to what I said. I'm not saying that sex is just for procreation at all. And I don't think it has anything to do with whether or not you have children or don't have children. I think it's a much broader sense of understanding. You know, it opens up into a whole understanding of social consciousness of your and how our actions affect all of us. Mm-hmm. And I do think that sex has been exploited in many ways. One way is it's put to say it's just for procreation has been terrible. I mean, that's not healthy. But I also think now in our culture that we're totally disconnected from the idea that we do have children. And I think I really feel like it's one reason why we have so many abortions, that we don't know our bodies. And I think as women, that's a very important thing. And you don't, now there's nothing of birth control. You've got the question of, if you understand your natural cycles in your body, that can maybe be some, you know, you may not...
You may not need to buy contraceptives.
It's a different kind of it's a different kind of responsibility. It's the responsibility of yourself and of your body and understanding those powers. It's not. I think one of the fallacies of our birth control, not that I'm not against birth control, but one of the fallacies is that it disconnects us from that responsibility. And it doesn't take the pleasure out of it or anything, but I really feel like we're just lost. I mean, our culture doesn't have this connection to the future.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I think.
And it...
Oh, yeah. I want to say something different. She has a response to that.
Responding, Melinda, to your thing and trying to think about Wendell Berry, that seems like a perfect carryover with how he emphasizes a sense of place, living with your consequences. Mm-hmm. You can't have a field we're finding and dumping chemicals on it forever and ever without some sort of detrimental consequence. And the same with yours or my body. And maybe as we learn to live in our own cesspool, we're going to clean up our act a little bit better.
I don't know if I heard right or understood right. You're talking about wildness and the relationship to fidelity and sexuality. My response, question in my head about singleness, and you had brought that to singleness and wildness and how that all fits. I think there's fidelity in singleness too. And
can you go into that? I think it'd be good to hear some of that.
Well, the thought that comes into my head right now is that I can have better relations, as a single person, have better relationships with my married friends who have a very faithful marriage. Mm-hmm. That I don't trust my relationships with my friends as well, who maybe their marriage is kind of rocky.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if I know a marriage is real strong, I put more out to that relationship that I have with each of those individuals, or maybe one of those individuals. And I feel like in the fidelity end of it, I feel like I'm pretty faithful to my own sexuality and to my own body and to my own femaleness and maleness. Knowing myself and faithfulness in that, knowing who I am and what my reactions are. And
okay.
Just random thoughts.
Dan?
Yeah, it's related that I noticed in our parish parishes I've served in, I think it's almost, you could say it's true of society, there are very few friendships between married men and women, either single women or wives of other men.
Mm-hmm.
And the assumption of society is once a relationship like that is growing, it's going to move towards physical sex.
Yeah.
And Wendell Berry mentioned that almost the basis, fidelity in marriage is the basis of community, because once a fidelity is established, then relationships can be very free with people to whom you're not married, because there's an understanding that you aren't playing a game that's part of the reason I've heard.
It is possible to imagine a more generous enclosure, a household welcoming to neighbors and friends, a garden open to the weather, between the woods and the road. That's the analogy. Remember, we were talking about the field and marriage. So your marriage as a garden open to weather between the woods and the road. It is possible to imagine a marriage bond that would bind a woman and a man not only to each other, but to the community of marriage, the amorous communion at which couples sit, whatever that means. The sexual feast and celebration that joins them to all living things and to the fertility of the earth, and the sexual responsibility that joins them to the human past and the human future. It is possible to imagine marriage as a grievous, joyous human bond, endlessly renewable and renewing, again and again rejoining memory and passion and hope. Now, I've thought about that for a long time, trying to figure out what it meant. And so all I could do was relate it to my own experience. And what I think, what I do is when I feel an attraction to someone, and it can be a male or a female, I enjoy my feelings. I look at that person, I enjoy being around that person. There's a special spark that go back and forth once in a while, and those are treasures. And they keep me going often, you know? I mean, it just makes life great and fun and special, because you know somebody cares about you, and if it's in a physical way, that's fine. This is my own opinion, I guess. And just to enjoy that for what it is, being faithful yet to your own, whether that's your own body or your own husband or your own daddy or whatever. And so that's how I read this. You're enjoying. Now, does someone else do that differently? Does someone else want to talk about that?
No, but I think what's interesting in it, there's a danger in it.
Uh-huh.
If to the degree that you become open and intimate with people, and I don't mean physically intimate, respond to them, generally, you don't know what's going to happen next. I mean, you have a kind of faith, but you risk it in that kind of relationship. And if it's really, really important to you that you never step outside, a firm definition of fidelity, you're going to play it safe most of the time. Whenever you feel things start getting dangerous, you're going to pull back. And that's kind of a gray line. It's not a fine line, but he seems to argue for a kind of openness and a riskness, which isn't kind of moral hygiene or horsing around, where you're really looking for excitement and adventure, you kind of like move on the danger and the whatever. But doing that while at the same time taking fidelity seriously. And part of it is that you've got to risk losing fidelity to have it in a meaningful sense. Mm-hmm. This notion of gift. It becomes legalistic, it becomes a prison. People are grimly dutiful, and they can be almost ecstatic about their grim duty.
Yeah.
I mean, they love being faithful.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah. The faithfulness becomes the thing rather than the person.
Yeah.
And he also says, he talks about that, he calls it a Victorian something or other. And he says the opposite of that is just like hot and cold, it's part of the same, where we just forget everything and are not faithful to our bodies or to other people. So it's just the flip-flop reverse side instead of anything that might...
No, I don't know better.